You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Buffalo Chicken Sub has arrived at Penn Station East Coast Subs. It's got the kick, it's got the crunch, and it's packed with bold buffalo flavor, melty cheese, and perfectly grilled chicken. Only for a limited time. Name a better pair than buffalo and chicken. Fresh cut fries and freshly squeezed lemonade? How about all of the above? Order the new Buffalo Chicken Sub any way you like it at your nearest Penn Station location today. Order ahead online at penn-station.com for easy pickup or enjoy it hot off the grill for dine-in at Penn Station East Coast Subs.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of All My Best Friends Are Digital. I'm one of your hosts, Caitlin Bailey, and I have with me my co-host, Mark Bigney. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm very well. I have recovered from the onslaught of holiday festivities. I am ready for what 2025 will bring us. How are you doing, Caitlin?
Oh, I am not sure I'm ready for 2025, but that is what it is.
Well, better get ready, sucker. It's coming whether you want to or not.
It definitely is. So today, once again, we're going to start with discussing the games that we've been playing lately. Then we're going to follow that up with our retro game segment, where we're going to be discussing a game voted on by our Patreon patrons, Grim Fandango. And then we will discuss our feature title, To the Moon. Finally, we'll wrap everything up by shouting out upcoming titles that we're looking forward to. So Mark, what have you been playing lately?
Well, despite the fact, Caitlin, that I consumed probably around 10 kilograms, that's Canadian speak for a lot, of chocolate over the course of the past few weeks, I feel like I've lost about 50 pounds, that's freedom units for you, because I have finally finished Dragon Age Veilguard. I feel unburdened, I feel liberated. I celebrated by immediately going and playing a whole bunch of Metaphor ReFantazio, and it felt glorious. It's like I killed a literal dragon, I can move on with my life. I will say the following. Now, we're going to go into a lot more detail in a Patreon bonus episode of our detailed thoughts about Dragon Age the Veilguard, because I suspect Caitlin and I have had very different experiences with it. I will stand by what I said a few weeks ago, though. I solidly rank Dragon Age the Veilguard as my least favorite of the Dragon Age games, which is not to say that I didn't like it. I didn't like portions of it. Portions of it I felt were very mediocre, and it dragged considerably. Overall, I would say the worst aspect of Dragon Age the Veilguard was pacing. I felt that there have been pacing issues in previous Dragon Age games, most saliently and strikingly the Hinterlands in Dragon Age Inquisition. But I think that the pacing issues in Dragon Age Veilguard were not only worse, but they were structurally more egregious insofar as they were handled in an extraordinarily clumsy way.
Yeah.
What I was not expecting, though, and I suppose this is very structurally within striking distance of a spoiler, but not really, the end game is a lot longer than I thought it was going to be, and it was consistently amazing. It was definitely some of the highlights of the game overall. Better to go out on a high note, but I do kind of wish that they had structured things differently. And indeed, the thematic elements that they tried to tie together, I could see what they were going for. It's not like one of those stories where at the end of it they say, so this was all a story about family. And you're like, what? I thought this was a game about soccer. What are we talking? It wasn't that bad, but it was definitely one of those issues where I was like, oh, so that's what you were building towards. I would have done that differently. Okay. Mm-hmm. And again, we're going to go into far more detail when we do a plot-specific version, but I will say the following just to sort of reiterate some of my criticisms of the combat engine of Dragon Age the Veilguard. I used the same four abilities for the entire back half of the game. Every level up felt superfluous. Every chance to respec was unnecessary. And honestly, at that point, I was just fiddling around the margins in terms of gear, and I didn't have any occasion to alter my combat patterns or my strategies or tactics such as they were. And I say such as they were because basically, as I said before during our review, Dragon Age the Veilguard kind of sort of wants to be a Soulsborne game, and the engine cannot cash that check. And so it just felt clumsy and sluggish in a whole bunch of ways, and I really think it was a missed opportunity. A number of people, listeners even, have been like, oh yeah, but compared to the combat engines in previous Dragon Age games, it was much better. Well, I disagree. I don't ever think that the combat systems in any of the Dragon Age games were the highlights of those games, but I don't remember any of them being as clumsy as this, as the one in the Veilguard, frankly. And I don't remember feeling so unsatisfied with the sense of character progression. And I do have distinct memories of, in every Dragon Age game, frankly, caring more about my companions in terms of winning a fight. The companion abilities in Dragon Age the Veilguard are very interchangeable. I didn't really care who was following me around. It didn't really make much of a difference. And I could just not pay attention to what they were doing for a long period of time. Not because the AI was so good that they were going and doing things effectively by themselves, but because they were so irrelevant. And so consequently, I stand by my evaluation that the combat in Veilguard was desperately unsatisfying. But I will say that the last few hours were very satisfying plot-wise, and they did manage to tie things together vastly better than I thought they would. But overall, this is damning with faint praise. So I'm glad I finished it. I appreciated a lot of the elements that went on in the Veilguard, but mostly I'm glad to be done, and going back to Metaphor ReFantazio was a lot of fun.
I'm very excited to discuss the Veilguard with you.
I have thoughts, Caitlin. I have thoughts. But then I went on to play a game called Crypt Custodian. This is a game that Caitlin got for me for Christmas. Thank you very much, Caitlin. This is designed by Kyle Thompson, who makes indie Retroidvanias, and his brother Eric does the music. This is a game about death in the afterlife, being manipulated and abused by a corrupt and corruptible system. This is to be distinguished from a retro game, which is a game about the afterlife being manipulated and abused by a corrupt and corruptible system, and our feature game, which is a game about the afterlife, which is being abused by a corrupt and corruptible system. Anyway, this is an aggressively cute game about a cat who is unfairly condemned to perdition for all eternity because, you'll appreciate this, Caitlin, the tutorial made them engage in acts of vandalism. And consequently, despite the fact that they were a very good kitty, they are condemned to be the janitor for the afterlife instead of being able to usher it into what is clearly the heaven equivalent. And it's just also manifestly unfair. I've consumed a lot of Sarah's Scribbles, which is a very popular webcomic. I was led to believe that all cats were basically damned from the beginning anyway, so I was somewhat surprised when there was even the pretext of there being a good enough kitty to earn access into heaven. But I'm going to set that aside, lest I get a whole bunch of angry hate mail. This has caused me to reflect, frankly, on what I consider to be a Metroidvania and what I consider to be something within striking distance of being like a Zelda game. Because it occurs to me that when just interrogating my own classification of things, that it might just be a question of the camera perspective. Because this is a top-down game. In point of fact, looks an awful lot like Cult of the Lamb in terms of presentation, animation style, and a number of other things. And to my mind, the moment you're top-down or isometric, you're not a Metroidvania anymore, you're a Zelda game. Because Zelda as well has some of the same like gameplay conventions of a Metroidvania. You get a new toy that allows you to access a new area of the map, right?
That's fair. Uh-huh.
So when I saw that the designer, Kyle Thompson, calls this a Metroidvania and it is classified as such on Steam, I'm like, what is the difference between a Zelda adventure game and a Metroidvania? I guess it's just the camera. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts on this issue, Caitlin?
I never heard it phrased quite like that, but I can't argue with you right now. So, I mean, yeah.
Let me be perfectly clear. I think taxonomies are occasionally useful, but often obnoxious in terms of how strong you decide to leverage them. We had a number of mutual friends, Caitlin, back in Massachusetts, who engaged in these endless taxonomical arguments, thinking that in order to properly classify something, you need to establish the necessary and sufficient conditions and then apply it with rigor. I'm like, oh, God. The moment you're getting it past the point of usefulness, this is a ridiculous, pointless intellectual exercise. And I say that as a philosopher, for crying out loud. So, yeah, taxonomy is a weird thing. This is just an interesting realization I made about how I mentally classify things. So in terms of it being a Zelda-style game, I'm really enjoying Crypt Custodian. I'm enjoying mm-hmm. this vastly more than I did the previous two Zeldas that we played, namely Ocarina of Time and Minish Cap. And it's a relatively simple combat system. Again, I find it vaguely reminiscent of Cult of the Lamb, but more satisfying mm-hmm. than Cult of the Lamb. So it's an efficient, tight engine that gets what it needs to do, and the rest of it is about delightful visual storytelling, some environmental puzzle solving, and things of that nature. I will also say that compared to Cult of the Lamb, there is so far vastly less poop. And
I was going to ask, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, well, it would be hard for it to have more, frankly. So there's no base building. It is just a sort of top view adventure combat type thing. But the controls are really tight. It's nice and responsive. It's visually delightful. And so far, just the weird sense of humor about how delightfully arbitrary and carefree all the representatives of the afterlife are has been very amusing, frankly. And this led me to another question, because I had to go and change something in the options. Because I realize that I have incredibly strong feelings about this, but I appear not to be representative of a universal consensus. I would have thought that everyone was on the same page, but it's really not. So, Caitlin,
okay.
Imagine for me, if you will, a gamepad. All right?
Mm-hmm.
You've got the four face buttons. You've got the four shoulder buttons. Two shoulder buttons sure. and two trigger buttons that are behind the shoulder buttons. All right?
Mm-hmm.
Where does the dodge button go?
Okay. I'm used to it probably being the rightmost button on the... the right side of the gamepad?
East, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
B on an Xbox gamepad, A on a Nintendo gamepad, yeah.
Yeah. And then every now and then I've had it as like one of the back of the two trigger buttons on the top.
Oh, one of the two trigger buttons. Interesting.
Like R2, for example.
Huh. The most common trade-off that I see is actually R1. I see dodge being R1 in a lot of games, and sure enough, okay. That's what it is in Crypt Custodian by default. Fortunately, you can remap it, because I now, largely but not exclusively because of Hades, have it very, very firmly applied to East, the B slash yeah. button. I just can't relearn that. It's now hard-coded. It's like A being the jump button on an Xbox gamepad, South being jump. That's just how it yeah. is. That's how yeah. I be. And in point of fact, I learned, actually, replaying Ico not too long ago, that I can retrain myself to do a different jump button vastly more easily than I can for a different button to be dodge. Because the dodge roll is the most twitchy of all twitch buttons, right?
Yeah.
You have the least possibility of thinking about what's going on.
Yeah, you cannot stop to think about what to do, or you've already missed it. Yeah.
Absolutely. So between the Soulsborne games and Elden Ring and Hades, for me, the dodge button will always be East. So thankfully, in the context of Crypt Custodian, initially I thought, oh, this is going to be a slow enough paced game that I'm not going to have to worry about it. No. The combat's, as I say, it's reasonably tight and pretty responsive, and you do need to use the dodge roll. And so mm-hmm. consequently, I had to remap it. But everything's fine now. They've even remapped things in terms of the screen prompts. There's not a whole lot of tutorializing. They do just enough tutorializing to get you damned for all eternity. But past that, the screen prompts match my remapping, so that's good.
Good.
And I was just curious to hear what you had to say about the dodge button. So I've been enjoying Crypt Custodian. I'm very, very early into it, but I'm looking forward to experiencing more. So thank you again, Caitlin.
Yeah, anytime.
Caitlin claimed that she was unable to find my wish list on Steam because I love, for what it's worth, my favorite form of Christmas shopping is to just go through all my friends' wish lists on Steam and then try to find a game, typically one that's on sale, but winter sales are very, very good, that I've played, to be able to give a game to somebody that I've played this game. It is amazing. It was already on your wish list. This is great. Go play this thing. Caitlin yeah. claimed to be unable to find my wish list on Steam. I think this was a pretext so as to get me something saliently involving a cat. But it worked out.
I mean, I think that's a fair assumption, yeah. But I did look at another... So I looked at your profile, and I could not find the wish list link. And then I looked at someone else's profile, and it was blatantly there. So I don't know. I can't explain it. But regardless, I'm glad that you've been enjoying Crypt Custodian. So.
Huh. Maybe I altered some weird setting. I don't know. I mean, I have it set so that every time I'm playing a game, I don't send a notification to all my friends. Because frankly, I don't ever want to have to be like, do I want people to know that I'm playing this thing?
Yeah, understandable.
So what have you been up to, Caitlin?
All right. So I have been playing a game called Infinity Nikki. I first heard about Infinity Nikki at the 2023 Game Awards, and it just came out, I think, either late November or early December 2024. So it's free to play. It's available on all sorts of things. I think PS5, mobile, and Windows. And you either can get it on the Epic Game Store or you can download it on the Infinity Nikki website. I also had played a mobile game in the same series that was called Love Nikki Dress Up Queen, which is, as you may guess, a dress-up game. And the main characters, Nikki and Momo. Momo is Nikki's cat who can talk and is bipedal. I don't know why, but they're the same, but the stories don't really seem to match up almost at all beyond the fact that they dress up. I don't fully get all the systems yet. I haven't made it through the game's like pretty extensive forced beginner tutorial. It basically like puts you through some of the story and you slowly unlock different things that you can do. But the gist of the story is that Nikki's exploring her mom's attic with Momo, and they come across this magic dress that transports them to the world of Miraland. And she meets with this goddess called Enna the Creator, who's been imprisoned for some reason. And Enna gives Nikki something called the Heart of Infinity, and then tells her that she has to save the world. It's a lot to take in the first, like, 3 minutes of the game. But anyway, I've only played for a few hours. I'm not super clear on how I'm supposed to save the world. Eventually, I think there's something called miracle outfits that I have to get, which I don't have. But generally, it has a lot of the same, like, cozy game things. It's open world. You can fish. You can collect materials that are on the ground, like daisies and stuff like that. You can groom animals, catch bugs. And then there's like mini games, there's quests related to the story, and you can craft outfits because you need to look like a pretty, pretty princess, or you can look like a pretty, pretty princess. So anyway, yeah, it's been fun so far. There's a lot to do. I don't feel pressured to spend money yet. It is free to play. But of course, it's also very early days for me to feel pressured to spend money. I mean, some games come right out the bat and they're like, yeah, you can't do anything unless you give us $50. That hasn't happened yet. I'm only a few hours in.
What does one spend money on in this game?
Other pretty, pretty outfits. They do have a lot of, like, they're trying to catch you with the fear of missing out. So they'll have limited time outfits. And, you know, if you spend some money now, which I don't have a good idea of how much money that is, because I haven't felt inclined to do it yet. But yeah, you can spend money and get pretty different, pretty outfits.
Is this the time that we mentioned that we are supported by patrons and we can go visit patreon.com/amfad so Caitlin can go get a whole bunch of new pretty, pretty outfits? Probably not.
Probably not. I don't know if this is the appropriate place. But it is more fun than I expected. And my friends have said that the story is actually legitimately good. So we'll see where it takes me.
I confess, Caitlin, I'm now on the Infinity Nikki website. And there's a lot going on. And I'm having a bit of difficult time processing it, partially due to cognitive dissonance. Because my experience with the free-to-play market is somewhat limited. I talked about dipping my toe into the HoYoverse with Zenless Zone Zero not too long ago. And I still have vaguely half a mind to try out either Wuthering Waves or something. I don't know. Something in Honkai Star Rail or something in that vague genre. But I will say this. And this is something that I find genuinely confusing on an aesthetic level. Just in terms of my expectations and experiences in video games. I am not accustomed to a free-to-play game involving lots of different outfits you can acquire, and for it not to make me deeply uncomfortable on grounds of sexual exploitation. Because these are anime-style, very young women dressed appropriately.
Mm-hmm.
And so my mind is trying to take all this in. Because, like, you talk about, oh, well, you know, you get new outfits and that unlocks new things. I'm like, oh, okay, Final Fantasy X2. I'm familiar with this vibe. Then I see all these animations of these, like, girls or young women running around in a fantasy environment. I'm like, these are reasonable outfits.
Yeah.
Wow. I didn't know that video games could do that.
Yeah, if I had to guess, I would assume that they're trying to have a... I mean, I'm sure that they would love for everybody to play their game, but I believe that their target audience is probably primarily women, and that mm-hmm. may affect the outfits. But yeah, they're mostly going for it being pretty or cute. Yeah, and for what it's worth, although it's hard to even know why you would know this, almost every single woman on this front page is Nikki, the main character. Her hair is just different, sure. or she's wearing different dresses or whatever. But yeah.
I get it. Infinity Nikki. Besides, Caitlin, I'll have you know, I hear from men all the time that they talked to some woman and she too hates the fact that video game characters can't be sexy anymore.
Yes. It's terrible. I'm oppressed by the lack of boobs that I get to see every day in video games. It's terrible.
That's an entire huge area of discussion unto itself. I'm just always amazed at people who complain about this, and I wonder what games they're playing. Maybe they're only playing Infinity Nikki. Maybe they don't yeah. know the existence of almost literally any other game that saliently involves female characters.
It's possible.
Okay, you fish, you play dress up. I'm seeing lots of weird activities happening on this trailer.
Yeah, honestly, I'm not entirely sure what's happening in this this looping video either. But you can groom animals. That's one of the things in here. You can go fishing. Mostly everything that you do involves somehow getting materials. Like you groom animals and you get some fur, I guess. You go fishing, you can get some fish. You catch insects, you get some bugs. But you can use the items that you get as materials for crafting outfits. I guess one of the other parts of the game that I only just got to, it's actually the main thing you do in Love Nikki Dress Up Queen, but, and it may even be the main thing here, but anyway, I only just unlocked it, so I haven't done very much, but there's style battles where you have to dress up, like you'll be given a theme. For example, I think the very first style battle you get, the theme is cool, and you have to dress up cool, and you have different articles of clothing that may or may not have the cool attribute. And you equip them, and you look decidedly uncool, but hopefully your cool level is high enough that you win the style battle, and then you usually get some kind of reward for that.
I thought Nikki sounded familiar. I've seen this mobile game before. I've seen people play this.
Yeah.
Specifically Love Nikki Dress Up Queen, and commenting how absurd it was that they all they were trying to do was dress up with certain keywords and end up with some hideous clashing outfit that in no way exhibited the keyword in question.
Yes. Yeah, that happens a lot. But every conflict in Miraland is solved with dress-up battles.
That sounds awfully civilized.
Yeah, if you want to defeat somebody, you don't whip out your Aladdin sword and go to town on them. Like, no, you challenge them to a style battle. And you have to see who wears the most elegant outfit or whatever.
I can totally get behind that.
But yeah, it's been cute and fun.
Besides which, Love Nikki Dress Up Queen totally sounds like a segment on RuPaul's Drag Race.
Yeah.
Well, I genuinely look forward to hearing more about Infinity Nikki if you're in a position to play some more, because there's clearly a strange and possibly dizzying world beneath the surface of what's going yeah. on there. So.
Yep, looking forward to playing more at some point.
Well, let us move on then to our gaming opinions on old school funware, aka Goof. We're going to be talking about Grim Fandango. It was originally released for the PC in 1998 by LucasArts, and it was remastered and released by Double Fine on modern platforms in 2015. This is a graphic adventure game in the old school style, more on that later, and is one of the salient works of Tim Schafer. Before we get any further, Caitlin, what is your experience with the works of Tim Schafer?
Let me think. I think I played Broken Age. That was him, right?
Yes.
Okay, I played Broken Age.
So he's basically Mr. Double Fine. So he's Broken yeah. Age. So his original work was he was an assistant developer on the first two Monkey Island games.
Yes.
He also was on the development team of Full Throttle and Grim Fandango, but that was all with LucasArts. And then Double Fine is Brutal Legend, it's Psychonauts, it's Broken Age.
Yep.
Because there are a lot of people who are huge fans of all of Tim Schafer's work.
Yeah, so I played Costume Quest. I don't think I've played a ton of his stuff, but I played Costume Quest. I think I played a little bit of Brutal Legend. I may have even finished Brutal Legend. I can't remember. It was a million years ago.
A million?
Yeah, a million. I know. I'm very old. I did not play any of the Monkey Island games, though. And in general, just didn't experience much in the way of the older LucasArts games. This was one of my first ones.
Psychonauts is one of those games that amongst the video game cognoscenti, they'll talk about how it's one of the greatest things ever and criminally underappreciated. I played it for about an hour once and bounced off of it real hard.
Okay.
I haven't really had occasion to go back to it, maybe someday. But Tim Schafer hasn't really been pitching games to my preference level for a while. Like, I did play the original Monkey Island games, and I did thoroughly enjoy them for what it's worth. I played Full Throttle. I thought it was only okay. And his style of humor, for whatever reason, isn't really my preference. It's not really my thing. I mean, I had no interest in Brutal Legend because I find Jack Black obnoxious. Like, I enjoy over-the-top rock music, but that kind of, you know, Tenacious D, Jack Black, and School of Rock and all that stuff just doesn't do anything for me. I don't find that very funny. I'm, in point of fact, rewatching Josie and the Pussycats. There's a lot of great comedy you can make about the music industry. You've seen Josie and the Pussycats, right?
I have, yes.
Greatest comic book movie ever made. But Tim Schafer has never really been to my taste. But the patrons, they want to hear about us talking about Grim Fandango, and so here we are. So, Caitlin, what are your thoughts on Grim Fandango?
I guess my thoughts so far, I haven't finished it, because I guess it's probably 10 to 12 hours long, but I played through the first segment for whatever that means. I thought the voice acting was great. I really enjoyed it. I'm liking the, you know, I think that the fact that they went with the pre-rendered backgrounds and the 3D modeled characters really helps make it so things stand out, because I feel like it would be very difficult to make. Like, I mean, I've played games where everything is like 1998 3D model and it all just kind of looks the same. And anyway, I think it's pretty cool. I really like seeing how, you know, a portion of the screen will become a video when a door is opening or something, for example. It's a little jarring, but I don't know. It's 1998. Like, what do you want?
It is simultaneously visually discordant and helpful. Yes, yeah. There is an obvious polygonal object superimposed over that pre-rendered background, but that's the object that you can interact with, so thank you for the heads up.
Yeah. I did not get very far before I jumped to a guide, because my brain doesn't work in the way that it needs to work in order to make any progress. I brought back one dude. I made it to the mass poisoning event. And I got him, and then I had no idea what to do. I found some new rooms that were open that weren't open before, and that was it. I couldn't figure out what to do, so I looked up a guide. And indeed, I don't know that I ever would have figured out what to do after reading what the guide told me I had to do. I don't know how people managed to beat this game without one.
This, to my mind, is the surest indication of the old school graphic adventure game.
Yeah.
Because I was playing PC games in the 90s. And none of them made any sense to me at all. I think this may be the reason why I still hate puzzles to this day, because in my head I associate what's going on in graphic adventure games with puzzles, when in fairness, they're not really puzzles at all. They're these absurd acts of association that really don't bear any resemblance to logic or structure at all. It's bananas. And I really appreciate how this is, you know, we talk an awful lot in Goof about how a bunch of games are time capsules. This is totally a time capsule for how narrative games used to work. Seriously. Yeah. This is what narrative gaming was for a long time. And I am so glad that this is not how they are anymore.
Yeah.
Because to my mind, there's Grim Fandango, which, by the way, is one of the LucasArts' last forays into graphic adventure games. Apparently they lost a ton of money on this. And so they decided to more or less stop doing it, because it was them and Sierra Games for a long time. You know, the King's Quest games, the Space Quest, all those other things. And LucasArts with Day of the Tentacle and the Monkey Island games and Sam & Max and all that stuff. And then kind of they stopped doing that around the turn of the century. And then there was this kind of a decade lull. And then Telltale Games started firing on all cylinders and like, okay, and people were talking about, oh, the genre is back. But it was changed. It was fundamentally different.
Oh, big time. Yeah.
Like, The Walking Dead Season 1, which was released in 2012, so a full 14 years after this, is as far removed from Grim Fandango as games can get, more or less. It's just, call me somebody who unapologetically prefers contemporary games in many instances, but if you've got a story to tell and can decide to gamify it the way that The Walking Dead does, or even the way To the Moon does, we'll talk more about that later, or the way Grim Fandango does, or the King's Quest games did, or the Monkey Island games did, I would take the more contemporary way 10 times out of 10, and I will ignore anybody who complains about how contemporary video games are too easy all day long, because if you want to tell me a story, that's the way to do it. I find the game elements of Grim Fandango Remastered as impenetrable and completely indecipherable as you did.
Oh, God. Yeah, like, I mean, I could see every now and then the hints that I was being given. Like, I walk into this area and this guy's like, oh, somebody threw something, you know, they just put their trash in the tube. And it's like, okay, cool. But I never would have known to do what you have to do. I don't know.
I would put the class of puzzles in Grim Fandango into three different buckets.
Okay.
Let me start with the smallest bucket. The tiniest bucket. It's very pequeño, Caitlin. It's very, very twee. You can barely notice it. And this is things that look to me like a puzzle whose solution looks like a satisfying, logically connected puzzle. There were a couple of those. I really enjoyed them. They were quite cool. Did I mention this was a small bucket? Then there are two buckets. The other bucket is I identify what the problem is, and the solution to me is obvious, but that's not the way the game wants me to solve it. So I have to go and do some other Rube Goldberg really complicated thing. Like, there are a couple of instances where you go around, you need to reach something or cut something or access something. It's like the main character, Manny Calavera, is literally a Grim Reaper who carries a scythe with him wherever he goes.
Yeah.
There are a variety of things that you can solve with a large scythe. But the game was like, we need you to involve three other disconnected objects and do this in the most roundabout, stupid way for you to proceed. Then there's the third bucket, which is the bucket that you identified, where the game, plot-wise, in terms of dialogue, identifies that there's a thing that I should probably try to do, but I have no idea why I'm doing it or how I'm going to do it. So it's not even that I've identified what the problem is, and I just have to find the obscure, stupid way for the game that wants me to solve it. Then there's like, oh, apparently this is a thing we're doing now for reasons passing understanding, and then the problem is equally incomprehensible. Does that sound like a fair characterization?
I think it does, yes.
And it's a shame because, going back to the first thing you said, the cast is amazing.
Yes.
The writing and the voice acting especially, but the writing as well, is really well done. It's got great pacing. It's pretty snappy. You don't feel like you're bogged down in tremendously long dialogue trees. But there's lots of character and personality. The main character is an actor named Tony Plana. You'll probably recognize him if you see a picture of him. And the one of the things that struck me, not to go too long about this, is you'll recall that when we were talking about Raven's Watch, the specific thing that I complained about was that it sounded like people doing their pet accents. And on top of that, it's a pastiche on fairy tales. The game didn't feel like it had a sense of time, place, or setting. Because it's just a bunch of disconnected stuff thrown together and a whole bunch of actors doing their regional accents. Grim Fandango, on the other hand, feels, despite the fact that it's completely almost absurdist setting, feels like it's of a time and place. It's got an Art Deco aesthetic. There's a lot of Day of the Dead touchstones, but filtered through a weird lunatic madman lens. And the cast is Latino rather than a whole bunch of local actors. Is that you can do a Latino voice, right? And it just makes all the difference in terms of selling the universe and selling the tone. And that all that stuff is great. I couldn't think of a single off note in any of the performances, and it was wonderful.
Yeah, I agree.
I love Glottis so much.
Yeah, he's so good. I was so glad when he turned out to be a bigger character. Like, I thought he was just going to be one note at first and, you know, kind of go away. But no, he gets to stick through. So, yeah, I was very pleased.
Oh, yeah, I'm ride or die with Glottis. Yeah, I was more or less in your position. I was stumbling through. I solved a couple puzzles. And then I broke out the walkthrough. And when I read the solution to the puzzle, I'm like, are you serious? And then I, you know, went through a couple of other things, fumbling around again, resorting back to the walkthrough really quickly because nothing made sense to me. And then the game hard crashed before the conclusion of chapter one. And I said, well, I guess that's it. We're done here.
Oh, that sucks so much.
It does. Whatever. Remastering old games is hard. I'll give them a pass, frankly.
Yeah.
That's a 17-year-old game for modern for modern platforms. It's tough.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, so overall, I think that I was enjoying the characters and the story enough that I think I will probably just play through it with the walkthrough, and I'm not going to feel bad about it because I want to see what happens. Like, it's an enjoyable story so far. I also tried putting the guide aside for a moment, and then very quickly, once again, found myself being like, okay, I don't actually know how I'm supposed to proceed from here at all, is what it is.
I was largely in your position. I was going through using the walkthrough to solve all these, speaking charitably, puzzles. And on the one hand, I was thinking, this is a strange way to spend your time, Mark. But there was so much charm and personality. I was enjoying myself. And then I got a hard crash and wiped out about an hour of my progress. And I figured, Nan and I were done here.
Yeah, not having autosaves, it sucks. Like, I'm not used to that. Everything autosaves now. And granted, at least the game tells you pretty much immediately when you start, hey, I don't autosave. You need to make sure to manually save. Yeah, I don't know. I don't think I would have the the nerve to keep going if it had crashed and I lost an hour of progress either.
I do appreciate the other modernizations they've done. Like, I've seen before and after pictures about what they've done with the graphics. They've done a lot of work on the graphics. And I've got to say, this does not look like a 27-year-old game. It looks, doesn't look cutting edge, but it looks very, very nice. And again, it's got a definitive art style and a point of view. And so consequently, I'm more than happy to deal with some technical shortcomings from the visual perspective. And they've modernized the interface to a considerable extent. Like, I played the original Scum games back in the early 90s, like the Monkey Island games, where you pick one of eight verbs and then you click all over things. And there's no context clues as to what on screen is interactable and what isn't. But they've done a lot of work there. So I very much applaud it. This was not a lazy remaster job. It was definitely quality. But, you know, at the same time, there are some technical hurdles you're going to deal with, like the occasional crash in my case, or as you point out, the absence of an autosave, which they at least flag. But
yeah,
there we are. And now a brief break to hear from our sponsors.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
And we're back.
So we can move on to our feature title, which is To the Moon. It was released in November 2011, developed and published by Freebird Games.
Hey, Caitlin, play Freebird.
I cannot. I don't have a guitar or whatever. Actually, that's a lie. I have so many guitars around me, but I can't play. Moving on. Platforms, it's on just about everything. It's on Windows, Mac, mobile, Switch, PS5. It's on everything.
It's also on Portmaster, for what it's worth. So if you have a handheld device that runs Portmaster, it's got a 4x3... screen ratio. So play it on your mobile device.
That's awesome. The gist of the game is you play as two scientists who have been tasked with helping a dying man fulfill his last wish, which apparently is to go to the moon. And they do this by traversing backward through his memories in order to eventually be able to transfer his desire to go to the moon to a childhood version of himself, at which point the memory device that they're using to do all of this is going to generate a brand new future for him based on that desire and fulfilling the wish, hopefully before he dies. He's in a coma, I believe, at the beginning of the game. So he's not a conscious person anymore. And I guess that's why they're able to do this, because otherwise, you know, these new manufactured memories wouldn't really jive with his real memories. That's To the Moon.
Yeah, it's a game about death in the afterlife being manipulated and abused by a corrupt and corruptible system, unlike the other two games we've talked about. There's one thing I just want to address right at the start. It is, I think, so striking. Can we talk about the Neil Watts of it all?
Yeah.
There are two doctors in To the Moon that you play as Caitlin says. There's Neil Watts and Ava Rosaline.
Mm-hmm.
How would you characterize Neil Watts?
He's a kind of a stereotypical nerd in a lot of ways. He's constantly trying to, he's like a little immature, like, you know, they're trying just do their, okay, he's very immature, but you know, they're trying to do their job and all of a sudden he'll just yell like, Hadouken, or the thing from Dragon Ball, like Kamehameha or whatever.
Well, the thing from Polynesia culture, excuse me.
I'm sorry. But he's constantly bringing up, like, nerdy stuff, like, and I don't say that in a derogatory way, but, you know, he'll bring up Doctor Who and how, like, oh, this is just like a Doctor Who episode or whatever. And he kind of sucks.
I don't think you've highlighted the things that he does that make him suck, right? Because when he's interacting with a sort of memory fragment that he then needs to subject to various samples so that they can get to the next part, and he says Hadouken or Kamehameha, whatever. That's fine. Yeah. That's him being quirky, and if somebody else finds that annoying, that's fine. They can find it annoying. He is verbally abusive, and he's churlish, and he's unpleasant, and he's mean to his coworker, and altogether, that is what makes me hate Dr. Neil Watts. It is one thing for him to be somewhat juvenile, but all the rest of it, I think you're underselling the extent to which he's the worst.
That's fair. I think that one of the parts that bothered me the most was when he was speaking to... So he was speaking to, granted, not the real man, but he's speaking to Johnny in Johnny's most recent memory. And he's being really rude and dismissive and, I mean, okay, I guess he's not really a, quote, real person because he is something that their machine has generated in order to let them, you know, access this memory. But he's not a nice dude.
He's obnoxious.
Yeah. He really comes off as this unsentimental jerk, and it's like, I don't know why you have this job and why you're doing what you're doing, right?
I would have fired him for just the way he treats his coworker, because you're right. There's some, they spend most of the time interacting with just memory fragments of their client, Johnny. And that's fine. It might have even been illustrative to the story for him to be a performative jerk to those on the basis, they're just automata, they're figments, they're not real. But the fact that he's equally obnoxious to the humans that he interacts with, the conscious, definitely real humans, completely undercuts any narrative import that might have had. And I hated him right from the start. Again, not just because he's quirky and nerdy and whatever. That's fine.
Yeah.
I've done lots of unprofessional things over the course of my life back when I had real jobs. And there were tons of people who thought that I was unprofessional for various things that I would say in philosophy lectures, trying to connect it to popular culture or whatever. That's fine. I might even be sympathetic to that part overall. Like, it was arguably not entirely unlike a Hadouken that one time he said Hadouken. Fine.
Yeah.
Not something I'd say, but whatever. But does he have to be so obnoxious to everybody he meets? They could have dialed it back like 60% and we still would have gotten the picture. And the reason why I want to bring this up first and foremost is because, as you say, you started off by saying that he was stereotypical in a lot of ways. We've seen this character in movies and television and games over and over and over again. And I have a very simple question. I sincerely hope that you have some insight, Caitlin. Why do these characters exist?
Oh, like the Watts character?
Yeah, why? Like, if he were a villain, fine, make him as obnoxious as you want, as abusive to other people, fine, whatever. But he's a protagonist. He's one of the only two protagonists of this game, To the Moon. This is supposed to be a touching, sentimental story, and very often it is. More on that later. What is he doing here?
I mean, I have some questions about that as well. I feel like toward the end of the story, it doesn't necessarily change. He's still fundamentally the same person, but he surprised me a little bit toward the end.
That's fair.
Not that that made up for his terrible attitude the rest of the game, but he it was still interesting to see this other side of him that I don't think really came out for the first 75%.
I still think they could have toned it down 60% and still managed to set up that sort of late game pivot.
Yeah.
Because I agree with you that that was interesting. But I was, in many ways, the fact that they'd oversold how obnoxious he was in the first pass undercut the effectiveness of that transition rather than emphasize it. And whether it's this guy or whether it's another character that springs to mind about, typically, let me just put it this way. If this had been season one of a show, this is exactly the kind of set of personality quirks that they would tone down for season two in response to overwhelming fan backlash. I'm thinking particularly of characters like Sokka from Avatar The Last Airbender. They're like, guys, like, we get it, okay? Just tone it down a lot. Ugh, I hated Neil Watts so much. Ava should get him fired. I'm sorry. That's all there's to it.
Yeah.
Thank you. I just had to get off my talk about my hatred for Dr. Neil Watts. Now, maybe this is exactly... There are sequels to the Moon.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple of other games that I haven't played that maybe I'll be inclined to try, and maybe they do a better job with Neil Watts in seasons 2 and 3 of this sort of setup. It's just, frankly, when he's... It's the abuse of his coworker who is, like... Not in response to anything she does that's unreasonable. Like, if she had engaged in some sort of incredibly condescending lecture in response to him saying Hadouken or something, fine, whatever. Then we have, like, the overly smarmy, holier-than-thou, by-the-book, even when it doesn't matter, versus somebody who's trying to inject a little bit of levity into their work. Fine. That's a very cliched dynamic, but it works pretty well. Instead, we had a normal person and an obnoxious person. Which is my impression of the two main characters. Setting all that aside. So this is a kind of structure, kind of playing with memory in a vaguely sci-fi setup that's very common in a lot of movies and stories that I very much like. So I'm thinking things like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Your Name, Inception, Relife, which is a really good one I recommend. Even Memento. Memento doesn't have the science fiction element, but this is the kind of structure where it's like, we're going to introduce some science fiction just enough so I can tell the kind of story that I want to tell and have the kind of beats that I want to hit. And I'm perfectly okay with that as far as conceits go. Some people are like, this technology doesn't really... I don't mind. What's your position on this kind of science fiction structure?
I don't mind that at all. I mean, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind was one of my favorite movies ever. So... Yeah, I'm on board. Like, you explained to me the conceit, and you're like, it just works. I'm like, cool, I don't care how. Like, I'm on board.
There was one element where, again, like, as a storyteller, you have so many conceits available to you. There was one element of the structure that I thought was overplayed. Like, there's some bit involving beta blockers, and that didn't strike me as very plausible. I think there were other ways they could have gotten to the same part. No need to get into spoilers. But other than that, I think it was all told, the structure was well done and the conceit was relatively well executed. So what did you think about the gameplay elements such as they were?
Yeah, so there's puzzles, and it's hard to call them puzzles, really, because, I mean, it's just... you get an image, there's a grid, it's going to be like 3x3 or 4x4 of this item, and you have to select these nodes either on the sides, the bottom, or the diagonal in order to flip all of the squares of that grid to the correct side. That's the gameplay. I mean, it's that and just exploring and finding items that are significant to Johnny. I liked that if you wanted like a more, quote, challenging version, you could try to get it done, like the puzzle done in the ideal number of moves. But you could also just wing it and there's no penalty. However, at that point, it's just like, why have these? It seemed a little, like a little bit of an odd barrier to just have in the game. It's like, just let me skip it. Like, I don't care. I don't need to do the image flipping puzzle.
I kind of appreciated it, frankly. I mean, I wasn't a huge fan of the fact that it tracked the number of moves you took for the entire game.
Yeah,
so it was a permanent record of how inept I was. But eventually, once it gets to triple digits, it loops over to infinity, which I thought was unnecessarily harsh on my performance. But fine, whatever, I'll wear that. It's like, oh, there's no real difference between 99 and infinity. It's like, yeah, I know, I'm bad at this game, thanks.
Well, that's harsh.
In terms of, again, especially when comparing it to something like Grim Fandango, I thought that it did a much better job of balancing narrative and my input. Than a lot of games. Like, it struck me as more or less in the same category as Hellblade. Very different games, but again, when we were talking about Hellblade, if you'll recall, it's like, how did you like the puzzle solving? How did you like the combat? And the answer was, it's just enough.
Yeah.
It's just enough for what it needs to get done. And in the context of To the Moon, the wandering around and triggering conversations and picking up items and things like that, and the puzzles, such as they were just enough. I thought that it was an effective set of mechanisms to gamify what was otherwise a non-interactive story. So overall, I was pretty pleased. It could have been a heck of a lot worse.
Yes, absolutely.
And in many ways, I think that Grim Fandango and To the Moon are interesting counterparts, because Grim Fandango, especially the remastered one, looks more like a contemporary game, and yet is firmly in 1990s gameplay idioms. Whereas To the Moon looks like it could have been originally published in the 90s, and yet is more firmly situated in contemporary storytelling idioms with respect to video games, even though it was originally published in 2011. It predates the big turning point that we were identifying in terms of The Walking Dead Season 1. In some ways, it was kind of ahead of its time, I guess.
Yeah.
I'll also point out that it, not entirely unlike, on occasion, Dr. Neil Watts, To the Moon knows when to engage in some ridiculous fun. Like, there's a sequence near the beginning that's kind of making fun of turn-based RPGs. There's a sequence near the end that almost acts like a twin-stick shooter. I was down for that.
Yeah, that was kind of cool. I liked it.
Yeah, it was good for a laugh here and there. So there's definitely signs of personality. So I guess what that leaves then is talking about the actual narrative itself.
Yes.
What were your thoughts on the story of To the Moon, Caitlin?
So I first played this game for Extra Life, which is a charity 24-hour gaming marathon thing. I think back in 2012 or maybe even 2011, which I guess would make sense because it would have been brand new around then. But anyway, I remember loving it. I remember that I cried, and I couldn't remember anything else. So I basically, as things were happening in this, I was like, oh yeah, that did happen. But like, I could not at any point have predicted what was going to happen next.
So the horse was a surprise.
It was. I was like, oh my God, To the Moon is a surprise horse game.
That's perhaps a bit of an exaggeration. There is a surprise horse. I don't know if it's a surprise horse game. Don't give people the wrong impression.
No, you are right.
When the horse showed up, I rolled my eyes pretty hard and was wondering how much that featured into your recommendation of it.
It didn't at all, because I did not remember that it happened. But yeah, I mean, there were a lot of touching, I think, quotes. Like at one point, something happens that Rosaline and Watts are looking at, and Watts makes some dismissive comment. You know, like, why do you feel this way? You know, we already know how it ends and it's bad. And she says, the ending isn't any more important than the things leading up to it. And I thought that was really like a touching moment early in the game and a good quote in general. The story really captured me. I mean, I cried more than once. And I mean, part of it is just that, you know, I'm a bit of a softie. I get emotional about things. But I really liked this way that they did the storytelling, you know, showing Johnny's life, moving backward from the time he was an old man, moving to when he was a child, and how some of the different mysteries are kind of unraveled as you move back in time.
What did you think about the way River was portrayed? So River is Johnny's wife, and They don't say this, but basically during the course of the game, she's diagnosed with Asperger's. Asperger's mm-hmm. is not really a diagnosis that is in vogue anymore. I say this in part because back when I was doing research in university, when I was doing medical ethics, one of the things that was one of my research interests was the ethics and sometimes the associated metaphysics of various diagnostic rubrics that we deploy. And one of them was the Class B personality disorders, which is to say sociopathy, borderline histrionic, and narcissistic. That has nothing to do with this discussion. The other was autism diagnosis. And 20 years ago, autism diagnosis looked very, very different from how it does now. And mm-hmm. 10 years ago, the same was true. We're making lots of changes in terms of how we understand autism spectrum. Some people, to a large extent, were moving past autism as a spectrum disorder. Frankly, yeah. anymore. Like, part of that is kind of, some people assert that Asperger's isn't a thing, that it's all just autism. Anyway, I don't mean to resolve any of that discussion. It's just when they said that she had a pervasive developmental disorder, I'm like, I know what this means. Because yeah. This has been true for decades. This has been one of the consistent elements in terms of autism diagnosis. You either have an identifiable thing, or if you're one step removed, you have PDD-NOS, which is pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified, which is to say, we don't know, and we don't know what to call it. And so the moment they started using that language, I'm like, I know what this means. And it was definitely a sympathetic portrayal.
Mm-hmm.
I have some misgivings about it, frankly. I don't know what you thought.
So, yeah, I was of two minds about it as well. First of all, I thought it was interesting that they had not one, but two female characters who are autistic or somewhere in that ballpark.
The other one is definitely neurodivergent, but we don't know what. She basically makes some comment to Johnny. It's like, look, you neurotypicals don't understand this.
Yeah, so Isabel actually had a really... So Isabel is the other woman. She was talking at one point about masking, about basically hiding who she is and presenting a more neurotypical view to everyone else, and how she's been doing it for her entire life because she was diagnosed early. And how, while it probably had made River's life more difficult in some ways, how much she envied that River has mm-hmm. never masked, because Isabel basically says she doesn't even know who she is without masking, because she doesn't know how not to do it, basically. So I thought that was a really interesting conversation to have in this game. I mean, especially back in 2011, I don't know.
I know.
Yeah. I don't know that I'd heard the word neurotypical ever before that. Like,
I was amazed. Yeah, frankly, this could have been, again, aside from some of the slightly dated diagnostic language, this could have been a story told in a contemporary setting, especially because we so seldom see stories about neurodivergent women because they're so chronically underdiagnosed,
mm-hmm.
precisely because of that issue of masking. And so, yeah, using Isabel as a foil for River in some ways, and as somebody who was better able to verbalize her neurodivergence, was extremely illuminating. So despite the fact that the terminology was all antiquated, the perspective that it adopted seemed shockingly current. And I thought that was great.
Yes. Yep, me too. That at one point, Nicholas is Johnny's best friend. And they were in high school in this scene, and they were talking in the cafeteria. And Nicholas is like talking crap about River. Basically, it felt like he was saying, like, oh, she's weird, blah, 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 blah. And then the fact that he ends up with Isabel, I mean, okay, he's a teenager. Teenagers are crappy, but it's still like, that was like, oh, Nicholas, this isn't a good look on you, buddy.
Well, on the topic of not good looks and the issue of neurodivergence, there was this one moment that really stuck with me, and I don't know if I'm making too much of it. But there's mm-hmm. a point where this happens very early on. This isn't even really a spoiler. A doctor, after diagnosing River, says to Johnny, I could recommend some books to you so you could perhaps better understand River's frame of reference. And Johnny just says, nah, I'm good. What the hell was that?
That was really weird to me, because we also, I believe at that point in the game, we had seen Johnny talk about how sometimes he felt like River didn't appreciate him. You know, he seemed to be struggling a little bit in the relationship. And it's like, yeah, maybe you should have read that book, dude. Like, come on.
setting aside issues of diagnosis, of neurodivergence, or anything, if you told me that there was a book I could read to better understand anyone that I cared about, I would freaking read it in a heartbeat. And if you, like, setting aside the fact that he'd already complained and issued that there were problems and friction and he didn't understand, and then some doctors are like, hey, it wasn't like, this is the key to understanding your wife, because at that point you're like, yeah, sure, whatever, dude. But it's like, hey, you might want to give this a shot. And he says, nah. And it just, it wasn't set up. They didn't talk about it again. It was weird. And it completely sapped a lot of sympathy that I might have otherwise had for Johnny.
Yeah, I mean, a part of me, generous way of looking at this was maybe he felt like, I love my wife. I appreciate her for who she is. I don't feel that I need to read this book that makes her out to be other.
Okay.
But that's the most generous way I can view it. And that was not supported by what actually happened in the game, just because it never came up again.
No, I appreciate that perspective. You're right. I mean, and a lot of people do have that response to diagnoses of all manner of different kinds of disorders and syndromes, be they behavioral or otherwise. Like, no, I don't want to, I just want to appreciate my wife as like, this is River. She's a person. She's not a collection of symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
So I will choose to adopt your perspective. I think it is the best way to situate it, because we're meant to sympathize with Johnny, and otherwise he's a decent guy. Like, it's not like he at no point does the stereotypical thing that a character would do in this context if we were supposed to think of them as a jerk, to be like, why can't you just be normal? Like, he doesn't do that. That's not his framework. And his complaints are legitimate complaints. Like, it does seem like River's priorities are in some ways superficially perverse. But that's just what it is in some cases to be in a relationship with someone. Their priorities are not going to be your priorities. And sometimes you grapple with that cleavage and that disjunct. And that's one of the themes that goes through the game. And so I appreciate that part.
I wouldn't mind getting into spoilers. But first, I guess real quick, there was one scene that made me laugh. So it's back in the high school, and they go onto this basketball court, and then I think it was Watts is like, oh my god, like he doesn't even know what a basketball court looks like. And I was like, oh, is this wrong? Like, because the basketball court had all of these like hard angles and straight lines like painted on the floor. So
okay, I don't remember that.
I forget exactly like what the context of the scene was. But there were various times in the game that I really enjoyed, because it's like, it reminded you as the player that you are just playing through, like, these are Johnny's memories. The things that he thinks are important are the things that are called out. That's why, you know, him and his wife are very clear. And then his best friends are kind of, you know, they're a little bit more pixelated, but like, you can still kind of see them as people. Everyone else is just a shadow or like a white model. Like, they don't matter because they didn't matter to Johnny.
I mean, one thing I would like to dwell on a little bit, because I thoroughly liked the gamification of the story of To the Moon. I thought it was very efficient, and I thought it did a very good job. I will say that the overall control interface was subpar. Like, I ended up controlling with simultaneously a mouse and a gamepad at the same time, because sometimes the mouse interface was substandard and sometimes the gamepad interface was substandard. And I reliably, you walk through the sort of field or meadow proximate to Johnny in River's cliffside house many times, and I never got a sense of what patch of greenery would block my movement and which wouldn't. That bugged me every time.
Yep. It's like, oh, that flower apparently is not one I can walk onto. That bush is not something I can walk into. But it was not at all clear. Yeah, that drove me crazy.
Want to get into spoilers?
Sure.
It's a long one, folks. To avoid spoilers, skip ahead 20 minutes and 40 seconds. That's 20 minutes and 40 seconds starting right now. All right. What spoilers did you want to discuss, Caitlin?
So I guess one of the things that I wanted to mention was, okay, so we get almost to his childhood. To Johnny's childhood. And Rosaline and Watts find that they can't go any farther. His memories are all messed up and they don't know why.
And conclude in a completely unpersuasive way that this will not pose an issue. And then everybody playing is like, this is totally going to be the hinge around which the plot rotates. But okay, fine.
Yeah. But no, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine. And they go and they, you know, they transfer his desire to go to the moon to the earliest memory they can. And nothing happens. His future is consistently the same. So they're like, oh my God, okay, fine. I guess we have to go back into the past, into the, oh my God, the squirrel. Like, that was gross.
Okay, so yeah, there was a lot of roadkill.
So much roadkill.
There was a lot of roadkill. There was a lot of pickled olives. I am pro pickled olive. I am anti roadkill.
Okay.
I will say that you went past the sequence, which I thought was the funniest part of the game, where okay. Rosaline and Watts are constantly jumping in and saying, have you thought about the moon? Like, by the way, about NASA. Like, increasingly yes. desperate, trying to, like, dude, you say you want to get on the, have you thought about the moon? Then we're going to bring up the moon. Like, just showing up at random memories, increasingly reaching and desperate. That part I thought was genuinely funny.
The school assembly with Watts as the NASA recruiter being like, hey, so you can join, especially if you're a brunette, and like staring directly at Johnny. Like, and Johnny's like, I don't want to go to the moon. I'm confused. Like, yeah.
That sequence I thought was great, especially in part because, you know, this was Rosaline losing it. If it had just been Watts, whatever, he's been engaging in antics the entire game, but Rosaline yeah. just showing up and being like, hey!
Yeah.
I've got literature about the moon. What the hell are you doing here, strange lady?
Yeah.
But you're not down with the squirrel.
It was gross. I mean, this is probably the most roadkill I've ever seen in any game, because there's, I think, 3 total roadkills.
I thought it was a pretty good solution to a plot problem. I mean, there's this comatose yeah. guy, and it is the case that your olfactory sense is very closely linked to your memories. Don't you yeah. have strong memory associations with certain smells?
I don't know. Maybe I do. I honestly don't know. Yeah.
Sometimes I smell something and it's just, I feel like I'm back to some memory from 10 to 20 years ago. So the fact that this was the way that they would make a certain association in the memory, especially to somebody who's comatose, I thought was perfectly appropriate.
Oh, so did I. Yeah. I thought it was gross, but perfectly appropriate. Because of course they, you know, they're in that disjointed childhood memory where they can't get anything to work, but they do smell rotting flesh, essentially. They smell roadkill. And they realize that they can use the roadkill in the present day in order to get old Johnny to remember this day and try to get those memories to work so that they can traverse them.
To be fair, though, just to be clear, my recollection was yeah. they did that so that he would remember the roadkill of that day, not so he would remember the yes. smell of his dead brother. Because that
oh
would
my
be
God.
Ghoulish.
Yeah, no, that would be horrible.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Unrelated.
That would be truly ghoulish,
unrelated
yeah.
to the brother.
Yeah.
Because they didn't know the brother was even dead yet. They just, yeah. they didn't know he existed, really.
Oh,
well,
good
Rosaline kind of did.
And that brings up the beta blockers. I was just, because beta blockers don't do that. You do not give beta blockers to somebody so they forget something. That's just not a thing that happens. And they really
yeah.
didn't need to do that. He could have just had a dissociative break. Like people,
yeah.
like that's a completely common response to trauma.
Mm-hmm.
I should know. I've had it before. And
yeah.
so they didn't need, like, so I found it a very strange framing that it was through beta blockers that they, like, the mother gave the kid beta blockers to forget his dead brother. No.
Yeah, I agree. That was super weird.
Again, like I said, I will swallow almost any science fiction framing if it seems appropriate, yeah. if that's the thing you need to do to get to your story. But beta blockers do exist. Yes, they do have effects on memory, sure, albeit not these. And at that point, that completely destroyed my suspension of disbelief for that sequence. And it was
yeah.
so unnecessary. You can have memory problems for any number of reasons.
Yeah, no, I agree that was a strange choice. Because especially, like, it's not like it's just going to make him forget the last 2 weeks when he learned that his brother died. No, they somehow make him forget that he ever had a brother at all. Like,
yeah.
really odd.
It was strange. And part of me actually wished that they'd, well, you know, you tell the story you want to tell. I was fascinated to a certain extent by the trauma of his mother and
yes.
her coping mechanism. Like, that
mm-hmm.
was really interesting. They didn't really explore much into it. I guess they couldn't have.
Yeah.
But that was now where she calls him Joey. She constantly calls him the name of his dead brother.
Yep.
And the various issues that he had with his mother about always preferring his brother and how that kind of continued after the brother was dead. Ugh. Very
oh, yeah.
weird.
I mean, she gifts him Animorphs books at his wedding, and he didn't.
Oh, yeah,
he's
that was
not
the
even
other
the one
thing.
That liked them.
Freaking Animorphs, man.
Animorphs. That was a bigger thread than I thought.
Yeah, I know. It was all roadkill, pickled olives, Animorphs. Very consistently. Because I never read any Animorphs stuff. I never consumed. Was there a show? I think there was a show. I don't know anything about Animorphs.
Yeah.
My wife did to a certain extent. It's just, I know that it got super weird. And it was all like very, like, do you have any Animorphs background?
No, the only thing I know about Animorphs is browsing, you know, books at the bookstore and seeing all the ridiculous looking covers where you take a child and then it shows like their step by step transformation.
Yeah, which the terrible always looks weird. CGI for, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Honestly, though, in terms of To the Moon, I thought it was great because it was just this weird little bit of color that's kind of appropriate. Like, look, some kids. So the kid was super into Animorphs. Whatever. Cool. Fine. Yeah. Like, when he and River were teenagers, they talked about Animorphs a couple times. Fine, cool. I thought it was it was a neat, bizarre little detail.
Yeah,
added it's a lot of little color. It was like the antithesis of the beta blockers. Just a little bit of detail that didn't need to be there that I thought really made things work really well.
Yeah,
I have serious issues though with the overall. I mean, I said and I meant that I liked the overall sci-fi framing. I don't know how well it hangs together. The more you scrutinize it, though, because let me establish some context here.
Yeah.
In the context of things like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, Your Name, Real Life, stuff like that, that is about certain desires and certain aspects of reality trumping whatever meddling you've done with memory alteration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, reasserting itself. The entire structure of To the Moon and of this business is to just give you a brief mental subjective experience. It's actually closer to Total Recall than it is to any of those other, like the setup of the story is closer to Eternal Sunshine, but the actual substance is far closer to Total Recall. We are just implanting a memory. We want you to have a subjective dreamlike experience close before your death. And so the ways in which they play with their having control over what they can get the guy to think and what the guy can't think and what he'll like struck, the more they drill down on that, like particularly during near the denouement, during the very, very end where Rosaline is like, I hope that River shows up, right?
Yeah.
If you compare that to the structure of these other stories that we're talking about, Eternal Sunshine, Real Life, stuff like that, you hope that the two people are going to make another connection in real life despite the fact that they've just had brain damage inflicted on them.
Yeah.
You hope that it's going to work out. Here, you're hoping that the happy memory that you've given the dying guy is going to have this specific detail that, like, so half of me is wondering, can't you just program that in? And the other half of me is wondering, saying, like, well, maybe Watts was right and you shouldn't have done this in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So it's this bizarre juxtaposition that left me a tiny bit less engaged. It didn't knock me out. Like, I was still moved by the overall experience. It was a little predictable. Of course, the moment they started showing the structure, it's like, obviously, River's going to be there. Obviously, she's going to work for NASA. Obviously. Like, it was so transparent. But whatever. It doesn't have to be a shock to be effective.
Yeah.
Did you have that same problem, or was it just me?
Yeah, no. So, okay. So, when Rosaline first decides, like, okay, the whole reason that he doesn't want to go to the moon is because of River. And so we are just going to, you know, River's not going to be involved in his early life. And then Neil Watts starts getting actually upset. This was the first time I was like, oh, he does have a heart somewhere in there.
Yeah.
Because he was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Like, you can't just erase her. Like, he wouldn't want that. He wouldn't want to lose River forever. He loves her. The whole reason he wants to go to the moon is because of her. Like, why would he want to do that without her? And then Rosaline starts saying, well, you know, if we don't fulfill our obligation, we could get sued. And I'm just like, how will anyone know? How will anyone know? He is in a coma. He is not going to wake up and be like, I can't believe you guys didn't send me to the moon. The man is dying. Like, that whole thing was like, how does that work? I don't understand. Maybe the machine knows, but yeah.
It also started made me questioning all the counterfactuals involved. By that, I mean this. Did he lead an unhappy life? Like, was he haunted by regret? I don't think he was. I was not presented the Johnny that had lived the actual life that he lived. Like, yeah, there were problems with his relationship with River. They didn't see eye to eye on things. She would rather die than lose I don't know why they named a lighthouse. That's weird. I don't think that's an autism thing. That was just a strange thing to, that was a strange narrative misdirection. So yeah, it wasn't perfect, but he wasn't haunted by regret. Mm-hmm. And he got to live a life with the woman he loved, right?
Yeah.
And contrast that with a life where he works for NASA, which also seemed pretty fulfilling. Like, he wasn't, like, the Johnny, the 25-year-old, however old Johnny, who was being shown around NASA, wasn't like, oh, if only I had someone to share my life with. No, he seemed perfectly fine, too. So the fact that we're led to believe that the only happy ending, that the true apotheosis of the story is him working for NASA and getting to meet River, struck me as desperately artificial the moment I started poking at it conceptually. In the moment, I didn't cry for this particular game. The games have made me cry a whole bunch of times. I sobbed like a baby during the last parts of The Walking Dead, just to talk about a game we've been talking about today. And I cried during Before Your Eyes, like all those things. Part of me was just being like, this is a little weird. I was moved.
Yeah.
But the moment I take a step back, I'm like, a lot of this doesn't make any sense to me.
So the whole thing is he's supposed to get to the moon. Did he or did he not die before they actually got to the moon?
Oh, geez. I don't know.
They were in the rocket ship heading, I assume, toward the moon. I don't know.
Yeah, you're right.
So it's like, wait.
Okay, well, metaphorically, he got to the moon because he met up with River again.
Yeah.
I guess. But again, that plays on the whole, like, what is it that he actually wanted? What is it that they're actually trying to do? Are they fulfilling a contract? Are they manifesting his wishes?
Mm-hmm.
Are his wishes to have been a fulfilling life or life with River, which he already had, but not really a life on his own terms with River or whatever? Ugh. As I say, the moment you start poking too much, it all falls apart.
And the stuff with River, so the last, I don't know exactly how long, but the last weeks, maybe months of their lives, she was making these. So, okay, sorry. First, he told her that he had, like, maybe less noble intentions when, you know, he first asked her out. And then for some reason, that triggered her making these origami rabbits. And all I could think, so I believe that this was somehow related to the fact that she met him back when he did have a twin alive on that festival day. Like, I don't know. I had a hard time figuring out how all of that fit together. Why did she make 8 zillion rabbits?
It didn't have anything to do with his brother. My interpretation was, and again, this is one of the ways in which I think its presentation of autism wasn't very good. I don't think this is a thing that a verbal autistic person would do.
Yeah.
She was desperately trying to make him remember. This is why I compared it to Memento a little bit, because a lot of Memento drives on trying to make someone remember something, even if they can't. And River was trying to make Johnny remember the promise they made as children to meet up again the year following. Because what they had done as children is like, oh, we'll make this rabbit constellation. And she was like, remember the rabbit? Remember the rabbit? Remember the rabbit? In real life, even on a highly autistic person would be like, remember the time we met as kids? Like, this is not something they're not able to do, right?
Yeah.
If anything, that level of indirection is the opposite of the communicative patterns that people with autism are known for doing, right? That is an indirect kind of social inference clue rather than just being like, why don't you remember that time we met on the log?
Yeah.
Because we met on the log. Remember meeting at the fair with the log? Okay, so but the game doesn't want her to actually say that because then the plot doesn't get to work. Okay, fine. Well, sure, I'll give them that one. Yeah. I'll give them that one. So that's why she was compulsively making rabbits, because she was torn apart by his inability to remember that they'd already met. And so she felt like, my understanding is that she felt thus that their entire relationship was kind of fragmented in an unsatisfying way.
Yeah, and the reason that she didn't, or that he didn't remember, is because I assume the beta blockers, because that was...
Yep. The beta blockers conveniently get rid of everything he needs to forget for the story for him to forget, and conveniently does not remove anything else that the story doesn't need him to forget.
Yep. Beta blockers.
When, again, dissociative trauma would have done the exact same thing.
Yeah.
I have a final question for you, Caitlin, about the overall structure of To the Moon.
Mm-hmm.
This business model that they have, that the company does, do you think this business model, as presented in To the Moon, is ethically permissible? Do you think that this is a service that people should either provide or request? I'll tell you why I ask.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is fundamentally, unlike Total Recall. Total Recall, do you remember the movie, the story?
Vaguely.
The idea behind Total Recall is that you go to a company and you say, make me a fake memory of a vacation I had. Or of something that I went and did. And setting aside the way the actual story works, the theory being that you know that you have fake memories implanted, but you just get to enjoy the memories of the fake thing that never happened.
Yeah.
Right? Not entirely unlike playing a video game. You get to remember the things you did, even though you never really did them.
Yeah.
There's no deception involved. At least, again, if you accept it at face value, setting aside what actually happens in the
world. Yeah, the concept.
I haven't read the original story, but this business model is one of deception. This business model is about rewriting your life in a way that you will not remember your actual life. Granted, it's just for a brief flicker in time before you die, but nonetheless, that's what it is. And so let's take Rosaline's perspective. Like, Rosaline and Watts have this fundamental disagreement at the end of the game. Let me recharacterize what Watts could have said. He didn't say this, but Rosaline could have said, we have a contract, we need to honor the terms of the contract, which is a moral claim. And facially, I think it's a pretty persuasive one. Imagine if Watts, instead of saying, but I imagine had he known what we know now that he would change the terms of the contract, which is a plausible claim, but let's say he didn't say that. Let's say instead he had said, this situation has convinced me that our business model is bankrupt. We cannot be in the business of altering people's perceptions of lives, of inserting lies, and then having to try to parse which lies to choose with respect to someone's memory of their own life, especially at the point of their own death. I want out. I want nothing more to do with this. We should stop inflicting what is in very real ways brain damage on this individual just before they die, even if they contracted us to do this.
Yeah.
I'm not suggesting that that's the way the game should have gone.
Yeah.
But it is, I think, it is a position that was definitely running through my head as the game was ending up. And I would like to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't stop thinking about Eternal Sunshine. How, like, ultimately in that movie, the main character is wondering, like, you know, why did I decide to do this? I don't actually want to lose all of these memories. And I couldn't help but think, like, yeah, why? Okay, I know that you're dying. But why is erasing every memory that you have to replace it with something fake worth it? Like, I don't know. I had a hard time imagining why someone would want to do that.
I think in this particular context, that highlights one of the problems I had that I articulated earlier. We don't see Johnny as someone torn apart with regret.
Yeah.
We don't see him as having lived a life, an unfulfilled life of torment and failed ambition. And in point of fact, the way that it's presented is, yeah, I don't know, I want to go to the moon. It's like, why? I don't know. I just, you know, kind of, you know. Instead of, if it said, like, look, I love my wife. I tried so hard to connect with her. It never worked. And I don't think she ever liked being with me either.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, therefore, that I should have just had a different ambition. And I feel like, fundamentally, it would have made more sense for me if I should have focused on my career. I had a scientific aptitude. You know, I always thought I could have been an astronaut. And I think if I devoted myself to that rather than trying to make this work, and I don't think it did, because instead, again, the game presents him. It's like, he had a pretty good life. It wasn't great, but it was pretty damn great. And he got to spend it with River, and they seemed pretty happy.
Yeah.
They should have done a better job motivating the problem in the first instance, I think. And that would have solved a lot of that. But even setting all that aside.
Yeah.
I was just wondering if you had any view on this ethical position, that the fundamental business model that they're offering, being one of self-deception, is morally impermissible. Because you're right, in the context of Eternal Sunshine, he changes his mind.
Yeah.
Midway through the process, he relents, he regrets, and he decides, I don't want to have these memories erased. I guess minor spoiler for Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, but it's a movie that's over a quarter of a century old, so whatever.
Yeah.
Part of me thinks that there is no context in which this process is ethically permissible.
Mm-hmm.
Either for the subject or for the company.
I think I agree. Like, I mean, I can't, I don't know. I have a hard time with this, but I can't. I would never feel good being Rosaline or Watts and doing this to somebody.
Fair. Going past that, I think, would have to require further thoughts on lying and truth telling, which is something that I spend most of my time thinking about anyway. So, but I think we could definitely agree that no one should want to be Dr. Neil Watts.
Yeah, I think we can agree on that.
Okay, good. I'm glad we could get to that. So that has been To the Moon, rather a lot of it. Thank you, Caitlin. I was very pleased to hear your reflections. I had a lot of thoughts on To the Moon, and I'm glad to hear what you had to say.
You too, Mark.
And so now we're going to move on to shameless hyping of upcoming titles. Shout. Caitlin, what would you like to shout out for us?
So today I would like to shout out Split Fiction. Split Fiction is by Hazelight Studios. It's the same company that created It Takes Two and A Way Out, but I haven't played A Way Out, so I can't speak to that. It Takes Two was an incredible co-op experience, and Split Fiction looks right up my alley. So it's a story about two writers named Mio and Zoe. One of them writes sci-fi and the other writes fantasy, and they both want to get published, so they visit this tech company that has technology that's supposed to help bring their stories to life. But then both girls mistakenly end up in the same simulation, and then the game alternates between sci-fi and fantasy worlds of each of their stories, and they have to work together to get through and escape the simulation. So, I don't know. It looks awesome. It looks super fun. So, I'm excited about it.
Hazelight definitely has a niche.
Yeah. Yes, they do.
They want to do the two-player co-op thing, and that's what they do. Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons, A Way Out, It Takes Two.
They did Brothers jam. Too.
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't realize that. I forgot about that. That's cool.
So I'm going to be shouting out some upcoming hardware. This is probably going to be more expensive than it should be, and I don't think that even I'm going to be able to get it, because I don't think I'll be able to justify the price. That is the 1X Player G1 and the 1X Sugar. So, 1Notebook is a Chinese company. They do a number of the weird sort of quasi-handheld things that are very much my jam. I'm in point of fact currently recording and editing on a 1X Player X1, which is a 10-inch tablet that you can slap on game controllers onto. So that's very much the kind of toy that I love. The 1X Player G1 is going to be a 9-inch clamshell micro laptop with a magnetically removable keyboard with game controllers underneath. And I think everything should have magnets, and everything should have game controls. So I'm definitely curious about that. The problem is it's going to use the newest AMD chips, which are very expensive. So I suspect this is going to be way outside my price range, but I'm super curious about the upcoming design. And frankly, 1X Player's build qualities have not been the best. They've been good, but they haven't been the best.
Mm-hmm.
I think that GPD, which is another company that does a whole bunch of weird laptop stuff, the stuff they make is, I think, of more solid build quality. But they've just been iterating the same designs, putting new chips in the same designs they've had for a few years. So I've already got the toys I want from GPD. But anyway, the other thing they're doing is called the 1X Sugar. It looks ridiculously silly. It is a two-screen Android handheld that like folds in a whole... I can't even describe it verbally. It all that's been released so far is a teaser that is incredibly opaque. It's got like weird flanges and folding and things flying out everywhere. But whatever. I am very interested in all manner of Android handhelds, and they're trying something new, so hats off to them. I suspect it's going to be very expensive and fragile, so again, I probably won't get it, but I'm very curious mm-hmm. to see how it develops. So that's the 1X Player G1 and the 1X Sugar.
Okay. The 1X Sugar. I tried Googling that and only came up with actual sugar-related results, so...
There's a Chinese company that makes very, very small, bespoke handheld devices called Sugar Cube. And this is a collaboration they're doing with 1X Player. And that's why it's called the 1X Sugar. So
cool.
Well, that's going to do it for All My Best Friends Are Digital. Thank you so much for joining us. It was great talking to Caitlin, and we hope to see you all again soon. Take care, everyone.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in touch, you can reach us at allmybestfriendsaredigital@gmail.com. Hope to see you again soon.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ12. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ12 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Buffalo Chicken Sub has arrived at Penn Station East Coast Subs. It's got the kick, it's got the crunch, and it's packed with bold buffalo flavor, melty cheese, and perfectly grilled chicken. Only for a limited time. Name a better pair than buffalo and chicken. Fresh cut fries and freshly squeezed lemonade? How about all of the above? Order the new Buffalo Chicken Sub any way you like it at your nearest Penn Station location today. Order ahead online at penn-station.com for easy pickup. Or enjoy it hot off the grill for dine-in at Penn Station East Coast Subs.